Welcome to Korean Context, a behind-the-scenes conversation with the scholars, artists and opinion makers that bridge our two worlds. My name's Chad O'Carroll and I'll be your host today. In this episode, we spoke to The Economist's South Korea correspondent, Daniel Tudor. Having been based in Korea for over a decade, Tudor has just finished writing one of the few English-language books to have been published in recent years on the subject of South Korea. In Korea, The Impossible Country, Tudor examines Korea's cultural foundations, the Korean character, public sphere in politics, business, and the workplace, as well as the family, dating, and marriage. In doing so, he touches on topics as diverse as shamanism, clanism, the dilemma posed by North Korea, the myths about doing business in Korea, and why the infatuation with learning English is now causing huge social problems. In the podcast, we touch upon several of these subjects and take a close look at some of the unique qualities that have made South Korea the country it is today. I started my interview with Daniel by asking him what it was that originally motivated him to write such a book.
Well, basically, I'm The Economist's Korea correspondent, so if I'm going to write a book about anywhere, it's going to be Korea. But regarding South Korea in particular, I feel that there's just not much in the way of books explaining South Korea today. There's a lot of North Korea literature, obviously. There's a lot of this sort of economic Asian tiger stuff from the 1960s and 70s, the growth era. There's a fair amount of ancient Korea or Joseon era, this kind of stuff. But there's not very much in the way of what's going on in South Korea today, which is kind of a shame because I think it's a really, really interesting place. Probably the last time someone had a go at this was Michael Breen. That was in, I think his book The Koreans came out in 1998 or 1999. Mm-hmm. I think that was a good book. But anyway, it's kind of a long time ago now. And especially in terms of the way South Korea develops, it's like a century where I come from.
Yeah,
and so I feel it's almost like it's just an open goal almost. Like no one's really writing books about this place, and someone ought to.
And why do you think that's the case? I mean, why are there no South Koreans, for example, who are making it their business to write about their country and their changing culture?
I feel that. I mean, the South Korean government is very keen on promoting Korea, and there's a lot of sort of semi-official or semi-official efforts to do this, but I think that the way it's been done is not particularly interesting. I mean, there's a tendency from Korea to try and promote Korea in terms of safe things, like you've got K-pop, of course, and from the modern side, there's sort of K-pop stuff, and then you've got pansori or traditional things, a hanbok or whatever. I think there's almost a kind of a reluctance to show people the interesting social change for fear of embarrassment, which is kind of a shame because it's actually extremely interesting and attractive in its own way. So I don't feel that many Korean writers are trying to show modern South Korea in its full cultural richness and how it really is, as opposed to how they'd like you to see it, perhaps.
Do you, from researching the book and having lived in South Korea for a while, do you think that the country is striking the right balance between fast change and trying to maintain tradition?
I don't think it has been, but I think it's starting to. I think from the Park Chung-hee era, from the 60s and 70s onwards, there's been this, in my book I call it neophilia, this love of anything new, anything that's, just even slightly old, get rid of it, tear it down, build a new one. But now you're starting to get, like the Hongdae district of Seoul, the sort of trendy studenty area, there's quite a few bars springing up that are very popular, and clubs that are playing old Korean music from the 60s and 70s. And there's more interest in hanok, the old Korean houses, hanbok, the Korean dress, all kinds of artistic and creative areas where people are starting to pick up on things that they'd really forgotten and ignored from the past. But it's still kind of, I think it's still kind of a minority activity. I think it's interestingly, so the cultural elite, if you like, or the artsy types are the ones who are looking to the past a little bit, whereas the mainstream is still very much, okay, my apartment building is 20 years old, it will be knocked down next year, and we will go for redevelopment and all this kind of stuff. Everything has to be new.
And what are some of the risks and benefits with the neophilia, as you call it?
I think that, I mean, in a way, it's helped Korea, you know, drive itself forward, and you know, it's an endless source of amazement, I think, to me and any non-Koreans, you know, who come to visit. You know, the fastest broadband is famous, you know, very famous for that, a cliched example almost. But in terms of any kind of new technology, Korea will always seem to have it, at least, you know, it'll at least be joint first in getting something new. But also, I mean, there's a tendency to, you know, throw away something just simply because it's old. But that old thing may actually be good and useful or interesting or attractive. And often, with hanoks, actually, the traditional Korean houses, now a certain type of maybe artistic or even the you know, wealthy elites are starting to rediscover hanok. But for a long time, it was actually foreigners. I mean, there's a lot of foreigners who have been buying hanok, and they were the ones for a long time who were trying to preserve them.
What are some of the qualities that you think are unique to South Korea and part of the reason why it's evolved into the type of society?
Okay, I think in some way Korea is very pragmatic. Korea is not really known for open-mindedness, but I think in some way it should be, and I think a lot of that goes back to this shamanism, the shamanistic religious culture, which is really, really open. And I think in some way, if someone comes along with a new idea in Korea, it can be adopted quite quickly once it's gotten past that sort of testing, oh, is this a good idea or not stage. But that's pretty quick. And I think once the sort of tipping point is reached, people will go for something, and society can change quickly. So the thing about, well, there used to be this terrible problem with abortions of baby girls back in like the 1990s, and that disappeared very quickly, and now it's now it's completely normalized, and people value girls as much as boys. So Korea will change very quickly. Also, I mean, just on a personal level, I think Korea, yeah, if I can talk about French, something as just personal as friendship, friendship in Korea is, how can I say, well, this word chong comes up a lot, but I think when you've got a good friend in Korea, you've really got a good friend. And so that's kind of why I recommend it to people. Just come here and you know, see what people are like, because the great attraction of Korea, I think, is not, you know, the government's always trying to promote, oh, this palace or this traditional kimchi museum, or it's completely boring. But if you just come and experience the nature of people here and you know, make some Korean friends, that's the most, you know, that is the greatest selling point for this country, I think. Also, Korea is a lot of fun. Korea is not known for being fun. It's known for making semiconductors and ships and cars, which doesn't sound like a lot of fun. But this place is actually, you know, just very simply, it's a great place to have a night out, for example. But people don't really know that. And so I've tried to express that a little bit in the book as well.
Let's talk about the, you know, Korean culture abroad and the Korean wave, for example. Obviously, people are bored to tears now talking about Gangnam Style, so I'm not going to ask you about that.
That's all right.
But, you know, obviously, Korean popular culture is getting bigger. But how do you think that South Korea can keep that sustainable in the long run?
Well, first of all, I think there's a lot of really good music and films and you know, popular culture in Korea. I feel in some way the government gets in the way by trying to take this top-down sort of "we're giving you K-pop" approach. Like the government, you know, will actually, you know, financially sponsor K-pop, And it just feels to a friend of mine who's running an internet business here related to media pop culture. He says these things are just too governmenty. I really like the way he it's just a very simple description, but it's true. It doesn't feel cool. And when the government's involved in something like this, it can't be that cool. But the thing about Gangnam Style is it just blew up and nobody expected it. Because it was just fun. It was funny, it was attractive, it was interesting. And so in some way, if the government would just get out of the way and let these things happen, then that would be good. So a bit less top down, a bit more diverse, I would hope. I mean, there's the really good indie music here that never gets on the radio or the TV here. And because their record labels have absolutely no money, there's no way they can promote themselves. But if people like that could have a better chance, and I mean, Korea is what, like the 12th or 13th largest economy in the world now, and it's had this first economic wave and a political sort of democratization wave, and I think culture is a logical next step. I mean, a country that is the a healthy democracy and the 13th largest economy in the world should have some kind of cultural impact on countries around it or around the world even. So I think it's been kind of an anomaly that all this time Korea's flown under the radar, and it's just, I mean, in some way it's Korea's turn. And so I think just naturally, I think this will happen, and more people will become aware of Korea, and more stuff will come out of Korea that attracts people, almost without trying.
Right. And in the book, you mentioned that Korean food in general lacks relative notoriety worldwide in comparison with other Asian cuisines. What do you think's behind that?
I think partly it's that Korea hasn't been cool itself. People have known about Thailand, people have known about Japan, and China for a long time. They've been interested in those countries, so I think it's more, perhaps more natural for people to discover their food as well. Also, during the interviews I did for this chapter, I spoke to a few Korean chefs, and one of them said, Korean food. I mean, I love Korean food. Obviously, he does, and it's good. People who try it like it, but it's not necessarily presented in a beautiful way. If you look at you go to a Japanese restaurant, it just, a good Japanese restaurant, it will feel like an experience rather than just we're going to eat something and fill our stomachs. And so I think Korean food needs to be presented in more of a, can I say, my interviewee, he said, half of getting a Michelin star is presentation and service, not the food. And I think the way of the nature of Korean restaurants has typically been just, we make good food, we bring it to you, that's it. There's not been much in the way of presentation, service culture. So I think that there's perhaps kind of a problem there.
Couldn't
But yeah, it's all, yeah.
you argue the service culture is arguably better with the buzzers on the table at
Oh, I love that. Yeah.
the
No,
rapid
I
speed?
love that. I really do. I really do. But there's a kind of quickness about it. There's no, it's not, it's not, there's no ceremony to it, really. You push the buzzer, the guy or the girl comes, and you say, I want this, and then it comes. And there's no ceremony to it. Whereas in a Japanese restaurant, or a French restaurant, it just feels posher. And so people pay more for it, Whether it's better or not, I don't know, but it just feels posher.
Now, in your book as well, you mentioned the influence of American culture in South Korea and American ways of thinking in various job sectors. However, there's been articles recently talking about how Koreans who earned their degrees in the US are finding it more and more difficult to find jobs. How do you explain that kind of
Well,
contradiction?
I think it's just more difficult for everyone to find jobs these days. I mean, it's
Right.
just so difficult to get a good job in Korea these days. Koreans are overeducated, and as this country has become wealthier, it's been more and more possible for a young Korean to go to the US and get a graduate degree. And I just, I mean, certain social circles of mine or people I know, everyone has been to a US university, so it's not that special anymore. So I think, you know, probably 10, 15 years ago, someone who'd been to that kind of university, you know, could have just, you know, I want this job. Okay, you've got it. Whereas now they're competing with, you know, 50 other people who have also been to Columbia University or Harvard and have this fancy degree. And so I think it just inevitably, because of the competitiveness of Korean society, even that which has been held out to be absolutely superior has now become kind of the new normal. But now it's almost, if you didn't go to one of those universities, you're really struggling. So the Sky, you know, Seoul Daehak Goday, Seoul Korea Yonsei University bachelor's degree followed by an American university master's is almost like a baseline for top jobs.
Right.
And so if you're falling beneath that, then you're in real trouble almost.
At the end of the book, you discuss how, despite all of these achievements in academia, technology, and so on, South Koreans tend to not be very happy. Do you
Right.
think this is going to change, or if what you're saying is true about how this competitiveness is, you know, continuing to increase, is it not likely that it could quite possibly just keep getting worse?
It's very possible for sure. If you look at the statistics on depression and suicide in Korea, it hasn't turned the corner yet. And you know, it's really sad, and it's something that I think whoever becomes president in you know, whoever wins this election next month, I think that it should be a priority for them. I mean, you would think that as time goes by, Koreans become more accustomed to being, how can I say, more secure, more, you know, feel that their country has achieved something, feel, now we're a wealthy country, we're a more stable, successful country. Yeah, I think you kind of expect this kind of feeling to die down a bit, but it doesn't seem to. And I feel that it spreads out into other areas as well. It's not just about academic or financial success, it's also about how attractive you look as well. So, as anyone who's traveled on line 3 of the Seoul Metro would know, all the adverts of a plastic surgery, and it's not just for women anymore, it's also for men. And it just, I just, when I see it, I just kind of feel sad. You know, I feel, you know, I love living in Korea, but I just feel sad for anyone who's caught up in this madness almost. I mean, I'm glad to be a foreigner living in Korea because of that. I'm glad I'm not part of the rat race. And I hope it changes.
In terms of that particular problem, there's another big problem affecting South Korea is obviously the low birth rates
Oh yeah.
and rapid aging of society. Do you think the two points are related, or
Well,
is
I
it?
think there's I mean, if you go back to like 1960, it was this big baby boom. The average woman was having, you know, five and a half or six children in her lifetime back then. And now it's only, you know, 1.2, 1.22, something like that. So you've got this big, you know, the demographic dividend was paid in 1960, and so you've got this big cohort of people who are, you know, 50 now, and you know, people in Korea retire early because that's just the awful reality of you know, these companies push people out when they're in their 50s. So you're getting a whole group of people who are about to retire, and yet there's not going to be another generation. There won't be enough people in the next generation to pay taxes and take care of them, basically. Yeah, I think in one sense it's kind of a payback from having that demographic dividend 50 years ago, but also right now, I mean, why are people not having kids? I think it's just the sheer expense of raising children. Because of the competitiveness in education, you know, it's not acceptable for your child not to jump through these hoops and those hoops. You've got to pay for them to go to this specialist academy, Hagwon as it's called. They have to go to that school, they have to go to that university, and all this costs a lot of money. And so I think for the average couple, do you want another child? Well, maybe you do, but it will cost you a hell of a lot, and you might not be able to afford it. So a lot of people will just stick to one.
And where do you see Korea in, I know people don't like making long-term predictions, but in 20, 30 years from now?
Probably a lot slower than now. We've still got the vestiges of this kind of bally-bally, quickly-quickly culture from that comes from the economic growth period. So I think that's going to go, really. I think Korea's going to be, we're seeing it now. Korea's already a lot more international than it used to be. So I think it's going to be, I'm very hopeful. I think it's going to be a very, a much more sort of tolerant, liberal thinking kind of place. And I think, a lot of the sort of the cutting edge trends, I think we're seeing a lot of nostalgia for old Korean stuff. Korea has a very long history. A lot of that was disregarded for the time of the sort of manic growth stage. And I think that's coming back. And I think the mainstream will come to embrace that. So I think we'll see greater respect and interest in old Korean music, old Korean films and art, and all the rest of it. Again, among sort of the among young people right now, there's a certain trend towards animal rights as well. I see more vegetarians than I ever used to, and so I wonder if that's going to be a trend as well. I think there's all kinds of social changes going on here.
Yeah. All right. Well, just to end up, do you see yourself updating this book? Obviously, you mentioned that the literature is not really updated so often, and things have a tendency to change quickly.
Absolutely. Korea just changes all the time. One of the people who gave me a quote for the book on the jacket, Michael Breen, he's the one who wrote the previous big Korea book, The Koreans in the End of the 90s. He said that with a new generation every 5 years, it's hard to keep up with Korea. And I think it's absolutely right. I mean, Korea just changed so much more quickly than, say, where I come from. And so, if there's demand for it, I think, I'll have to update this all the time. And yeah, a good thing too. I mean, I'll look forward to it. I just hope that people would like me to.
All right, great. Thanks very much for taking part, and yeah, keep up the good work.
Thanks very much. Thanks.
I do hope you enjoyed today's podcast. You can download other episodes at our podcast website, which you can find at keia.podbean.com. That's keia.podbean.com. We'd also really appreciate if you could leave us some feedback using the comment system on either the Podbean website or directly on our iTunes page. If you'd like to suggest a candidate or topic for a future episode, be sure to drop me an email at ocarroll@keia.org. That's ocarroll@keia.org. Thanks for tuning in, and I hope you can join us next time.